How Iraq Was Lost. Today, Tuesday, July 29th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A documentary filmmaker goes back and pieces together the moments where the U.S. seemed to have lost the war in Iraq. It was, he says, an alarming exercise.
Alarming because you were reminded of what you didn't know and what you didn't know you knew. And, you know, there were all those Rumsfeld-like moments that happened, and you just say to yourself, oh my God, watch this. This is Vietnam again.
Plus, investigators are still trying to reach the crash site of MH17 in eastern Ukraine, but fierce fighting is blocking their way. This reporter in Donetsk says there's not much they can do about it.
As far as I can tell, the vast majority of them just seem to spend the whole time sitting around in the hotel eating club sandwiches.
All that, plus a Russian ban on undies just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Sad as it is to say, the news from Gaza hasn't changed much since yesterday. Israel has only broadened its bombardment, and diplomacy seems to be ineffective. So we're going to hit pause on the Gaza story today and turn to another story in the same geographic neighborhood. For the American veterans of the war in Iraq, we've heard about their sadness and heavy hearts in recent months. The country they fought for, some died for, is not a picture of stability right now, not by a long shot. Just today, the Sunni extremist group ISIS blew up a key bridge north of Baghdad. The Iraqi army is ill-equipped to fight the insurgency, and the White House doesn't have any easy answers. All this is the subject of a new documentary airing tonight on PBS, produced by our WGBH sister program, Frontline. It's called Losing Iraq.
What's going on in Iraq is not 800 Syrian militants running into Iraq. It's the Sunnis, tribes, probably 20% of the country, have lost patience with the government in Baghdad led by Prime Minister Maliki, and encouraged by the Syrian war, and in part armed by the Syrian war, have risen up.
That's journalist Thomas Ricks, and Frontline's Michael Kirk, the director of this film, joins me in the studio. There are so many moments in the Iraq narrative where you could say, aha, that's where it went wrong. That's when the sectarianism started. But let's go back to the beginning of the Coalition Provisional Authority and Paul Bremer, who was kind of the American viceroy, because it shows the foundations of where we are today.
You really realize that this interplay of hubris and lack of experience, and Bremer had no preparation for this job. He knew very little about the Middle East, doesn't speak any Arabic or other languages in the region, and I think goes in there believing in some way, well, I'll be the civilian authority, I'll get the lights running, I'll get the water going, I'll get a kind of government established to get the military out of there, impose America on it, get a democracy going, drain the swamp, all those aphorisms that were roiling around at those times in front of all of us. Bremer was our tip of the spear who went in naively and in some ways is the ultimate metaphor for what happened.
And one particular move that Paul Bremer made in those first few days that we can actually see leading to the current sectarianism, what was that?
Well, the first one was something called CPA, number one. And the idea was get rid of Saddam's Ba'athists, largely Sunni. The Sunni minority had dominated in political and educational and cultural terms Iraq. The idea was if you could get them out of the government, you'll get rid of the harbinger of Saddam. People will rise up from the Shiite world and the other Sunni and Kurd worlds, and they'll all say, okay, well, we'll collaborate and everything will be all right. So his very first order, in the face of great struggles by the CIA and the other Office of Humanitarian Assistance run by General Jay Garner, who had come in and said, no, don't do this. 50,000 people are going to be angry at us, and they're the wrong people to be angry at us. He nevertheless went forward with this idea. And by saying that this was the rule of the land, anywhere from 20 to 50,000 Ba'athists by nightfall were mad at America and had a kind of grudge that would eventually probably, you could draw a direct DNA line into the insurgency.
Michael, when you spoke with experts like General Jack Keane, who told former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld not to invade Iraq, that it was a bad idea, did you hear any plausible scenarios in which the war could have been prosecuted in a way that would not have led to the sectarianism that we see today?
I think looking back, which is easy to do for them and for us as journalists and as viewers, it was bad from the very, very beginning. Keane would tell you that never was the idea even, this is astonishing to me, the idea of an insurgency, the idea of sectarian violence, the idea of the potential roiling trouble that was going to emerge, never seemed to cross the table as they're negotiating. So what do we do? How many guys will stay? How many people? What kind of forces do we need? Who should come in when the initial troopers are gone? None of that was part of the planning. And somebody like Keane could look back on it now, as he did then, and say, hey, we're going down into the quicksand here.
Michael, what was it like for you? Because, you know, as you said, you've been covering the story for the last 10, 12, 13 years, spoken with a lot of people along the way. What was it like for you to kind of go back through the whole narrative of the U.S. invasion of Iraq up to the present day?
It was 3.5 weeks ago that we said the ISIS moment is not more than a moment. It's the next act, and here we go. Yeah. To see all of that start to happen on the screen in the last 3 weeks was, for me, literally alarming. It was these moments that were both prescient as we were gathering them and didn't really know the way they would fit into some future narrative like now, and at the same time, alarming because you were reminded of what you didn't know and what you didn't know you knew. And, you know, there were all those Rumsfeld-like moments that happen, and you just say to yourself, oh, my God, watch this. This is Vietnam again.
Well, alarming, too, in the footage that you've got in here, because this is a pretty violent episode of Frontline. I mean, it's the Iraq story, so we know what to kind of sort of anticipate. But you're showing images of pictures that we've heard about but haven't really seen, the burned bodies of those contractors. We've seen them before, kind of blurred out, and the camera doesn't really linger, but you guys linger in this episode. What were those discussions about, and what was that like for you to kind of almost be re-traumatized, all this stuff?
Well, it was re-traumatizing. It is, we made the decision to show the war in all of its gruesomeness, as compacted as it can be, because we have all of that footage and all of those battles, Fallujah 1, Fallujah 2, the Sumara mosque bombing. So we thought it seems really important to not only talk about the political history of what happened, but to show viewers what was that really like.
At the end of the doc, you've got Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq as well as Afghanistan. He's intoning pretty ominously, just as we're sitting in Washington, I can assure you ISIS is in Mosul figuring out how to get at us next. I assume he meant the U.S., and I'm just wondering, I mean, does that mean Iraq's going to weigh on Obama's balance of his term in the presidency?
Seems like it has to. I mean, seems like whether he wants it to or not. There were 16,000 people from the State Department in Iraq. We were hardwired into how that government ran. When we pulled 10,000 people in those first months in 2011 out of there, not only did we unleash forces in Iran and others that came in and impinged on Maliki, we unleashed the worst aspects of his fears and worries about the Sunnis, about sectarian conflict, about his own generals in a coup. The bloodbath began in small measure and now increasing measure. But for right now, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, who didn't want anything to do with this, has it tapping him on the shoulder. But oh my God, you listen to Crocker at the end of this film and you say to yourself, this is just the beginning of something that could go very badly, not only for the president, but for America.
And the Mideast.
And definitely the Mideast.
Michael Kirk, producer of Losing Iraq, tonight on PBS. You can check your local listings. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Another player in the Iraq chaos are the Kurds. When ISIS, or ISIS, swept through northern Iraq last month, the Kurds stepped up to secure their semi-autonomous region. They've also stepped up to control the oil there. And that's not going down well with the central government in Baghdad. Marine Olivezi has this story from Iraqi Kurdistan.
So we're driving towards the crest of a range of mountains that mark the Iraqi-Iranian border. It's a dramatic landscape of cedars and parched grass. It looks and it feels very isolated, and yet it's a very busy road these days. Dozens of Iranian tankers are making their way down this valley, and in a few hours they'll be hitting gas stations across Iraq's Kurdish region.
This vehicle out there with Iran plate on it, it just got here from Iran just a few minutes ago.
That's Umid Hamid. He's the owner of a gas station in Kirkuk, about 5 hours from the Iranian border. The ISIS onslaught has hit the oil industry hard. The radical Islamists overran Mosul and large swaths of the country's northwestern region, which includes the town of Beji and its refinery, the largest in Iraq. Stocks of the so-called Beji oil dwindled and finally ran out here, leaving Kurdish authorities with no choice but import. Now with the Iranian gas, there's fuel in the pumps, but fewer customers. Hamid says the price tripled overnight.
Short, yeah, they're all going crazy. It's like, what's going on? Why is the price going so high?
Yeah,
it's very expensive. Many people just decide not to buy.
Despite the long lines and the increased cost for gas, the ISIS offensive has been relatively good for Kurds. Kurdish armed forces, the Peshmerga, expanded the area of control to cities like Kirkuk. And then in mid-July, the Peshmerga seized two key oil facilities outside the city. Baghdad called it a takeover. Iraqi government officials accused Kurds of capitalizing on the chaos. Lieutenant Colonel Ahmed Aziz says that's not what happened. He's a battalion commander in the area, and his forces fall under Baghdad's authority. He says the Peshmerga moved in because he personally asked them to protect the oil fields. Islamic State militants are just 12 miles away. His troops and the oil fields were left exposed.
I've been reporting to Baghdad, telling him about my needs here for the battalion and the area. No one listened to me, and we did not get any, extra recruits. Now, as a battalion commander in charge of the security of the oil facilities in this area, I have the right to request help from whoever is available.
The Peshmerga were available, and they came fast, but they didn't come alone. We meet one Kurdish oil engineer who's been working in this facility for years. He wants to remain anonymous. Let's call him Alwan. He says most of the workers at oil stations are Arabs. But when the Peshmerga moved in, they brought along a new staff.
The people who were brought in, the new people, they're mostly Kurdish?
Yes.
Could it seem like,
invasion? As a Kurdish, we consider that as a part of the Kurdistan, Kirkuk. Everything goes back to its normal place, I think. I'm pleased with this.
For decades, Kurds weren't allowed to work in the oil industry. Alwan says that Kurds taking over jobs isn't payback. His Arab colleagues were given the choice to stay or to leave. But with tensions running high between both communities, he says most Arabs felt like they were being forced out. Few of them have shown up for work since. On the other hand, Alwan and many Kurds say they're pleased with the takeover, though they know it won't fix the oil crunch. Refineries in Iraqi Kurdistan can only process about a third of the crude oil extracted every day. Alwan says it's a shame, though, that Kurds have to resort to imports in such an oil-rich region.
I feel very sad. I'm an oil engineer. Let me tell you something. We have a super giant oil field, and that's incredible, unbelievable to bring oil from Iran.
Yet this will probably go on for months until Kurds build new refineries. Alwan says that could take up to 2 years, and only then will Kurdish authorities cash in on the oil fields they just took control of. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Kirkuk.
The situation in Iraq is a moving story that The World is staying with. You can get the latest from our newsroom on Twitter with what we're seeing and hearing. Follow us. We're at PRI The World, and you can always keep an eye on what I'm reading. I'm at Marco Werman, and this is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. Zhou Yongkang, his power and his influence in the Chinese oil sector, have earned him the nickname China's Dick Cheney. But in Zhou's case, power has brought him down, it seems. He's now under investigation for corruption. The investigation's been kind of an open secret for months, but today China's state news agency made it official. So a big deal or just inside politics in the midst of a corruption crackdown in China? Isaac Stonefish is the Asia editor at Foreign Policy magazine. Is the Dick Cheney parallel an accurate one, Isaac?
I think the Dick Cheney parallel is a very good one in that it demonstrates just how important Zhou was in the Chinese system. And it also hints at the massive amount of power that Zhou was able to accumulate behind the scenes. Zhou was a member of the Politburo Standing Committee from 2007 to 2012. He was officially ranked 9th, but he was believed to be the third most powerful man in China.
Right. So accumulation of power and accumulation, it's got to be said, of a lot of money. Is it a big deal then that Zhou is now under investigation?
Zhou has not been seen in public since October of last year. And usually former leaders who have doubts cast on them show up in places just to let people know that they're still alive, that they're still under the red sun of the Communist Party. People had basically all but assumed that Zhou was done for since December or January. And the fact that the party has announced it means that, you know, someone up there feels like they have their ducks enough in a row to move forward on the prosecution of Zhou. So it is a big deal because it means that they're ready for the next step.
Right. And as I said, this is kind of part of a whole corruption crackdown in China. But it seems Chinese President Xi Jinping is pretty eager to go after Zhou Yongkang. Why is that? Because there are plenty of corrupt officials to go around these days.
We don't know exactly why Xi has targeted Zhou, but there's a couple of leading theories. One is that Zhou supported Bo Xilai, the former Chongqing Party secretary who fell in a spectacular fashion in 2012. Right. Zhou was reportedly the only one on the standing committee to support Bo to vote against his ouster. So this could be payback for that. It could be that Zhou was in fact more corrupt than a lot of the other officials. And it could just be that Xi Jinping wanted to steer the country away from some of the policies that Zhou Yongkang championed. Mm. Zhou was very known for something called Weiwen, which is stability maintenance. And that was responsible for a lot of the repression that we've seen over the last 5 years or so in the region of Xinjiang in northwest China and in Tibet. So getting rid of Zhou could be a signal about liberalization possibly as well.
The Chinese government, according to Reuters, has seized assets worth $14 billion from Zhou and his associates. I mean, that's a lot of money. Was it all from the oil sector? Where did it come from?
That is a lot of money, and it's very, very difficult to say. I think probably most of his money, if these allegations are true, came from connections he made in the energy sector and also probably in real estate as well. Just by having access to all of that land and then being able to sell it. Zhou was also formerly Minister of Land and Resources. So that also probably really helped line his pocketbook.
Isaac, since the investigation against Zhou Yongkang wasn't made kind of public, officially public until today, do you think we'll ever know what's going on with the investigation until some final announcement is given when prosecution is complete?
That's a very good question. I mean, there's so many tantalizing rumors floating around, but I think until either the Communist Party liberalizes and opens up the archives, or until we get a really, really great leaker, I don't think we're going to find out what exactly is going on behind the closed doors of Zhongnanhai, the seat of the government in Beijing.
Isaac Stonefish from Foreign Policy magazine, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
Corruption in China is so pervasive these days, even the Happy Meal hasn't been spared. That's since new evidence surfaced in recent weeks showing a Chinese food company cutting corners on meat safety. The company is Shanghai Huxi Food, and it's a major supplier to such foreign fast food chains in China as McDonald's, KFC, and Pizza Hut. Chinese media filmed workers at the factory appearing to repackage expired meat, even scooping it off the floor before shipping it off to some big-name American chains in China. Yuck. McDonald's there has responded by taking meat off its menu. So what do you do if you're jonesing for a Big Mac in Shanghai right now? Ruth Morris went to find out.
Walk into a McDonald's at the upscale Jing'an Shopping Center in Shanghai, and you'll see a lot of filet-o-fish sandwiches and French fries. You'll also see a notice at the cash register apologizing for the restaurant's limited offerings. What you won't see? Big Macs and quarter pounders. Rita, an expat from Korea, is here with her 5-year-old daughter, who's picking at her food.
I wanted to order Happy Meal with a cheeseburger for her, but I couldn't because they said they don't have. So I have to order fish burger and one for chicken burger for me.
The beef shortage is a result of last week's investigative news report by Shanghai-based Dragon TV. It accused a Shanghai company of repackaging expired meat and shipping it off to fast food chains like McDonald's and KFC in China. Restaurants stopped using the meat, and the supplier's American parent company, OSI Group, withdrew all products made at the Shanghai unit.
We love to believe, you know, like McDonald's,
Rita says we love to believe that big multinational companies with big brands to protect will go the extra mile to make sure the food they serve is safe. If she's in a foreign country and not sure whether local food might make her daughter sick, McDonald's it is. Engineer Yu Dongming is also finishing off a fillet of fish. He thinks McDonald's has done a good job responding to the food safety concerns by taking suspicious beef off the menu. In fact, some Chinese customers say they have more trust in American fast food restaurants than Chinese ones. But Yu thinks U.S.-based OSI has some explaining to do.
We know that we have let down our customers, the government, and the people of China.
OSI Chief Sheldon Lavin traveled to Shanghai to apologize for the tainted meat in a Monday press conference. His tone was contrite.
And we understand that we need to rebuild and again earn respect, trust, reputation, and forgiveness.
But some consumers are not in a forgiving mood. Outside one McDonald's restaurant, I met Wang Yao. She was waiting to be seated at a much busier dumpling restaurant next door. She told me she'd decided not to eat at McDonald's in China ever again. She said she would trust McDonald's if she were traveling abroad. Seated nearby, I met Spaniard Xavier San Juan, a sales manager for a trading company that ships Chinese goods to Spain. He said he felt the cards were stacked against foreign companies in China. State-run media have been criticized for playing up foreign companies' missteps while playing down wider food safety concerns, like the thousands of dead pigs found floating in a Chinese river last year. San Juan said he will continue to eat at McDonald's in China, meat or no meat. The company says it may take until early August or even longer to get beef back in their hamburger buns. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
I'm Marco Werman. Back in the mid-1980s, the Soviets banned a popular product.
When they disallowed alcohol, specifically vodka, there were riots on the street.
That didn't work out so well, and now the Russian parliament has banned synthetic underwear. Russian lingerie lovers unite. That's just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Max Seddon of BuzzFeed has a powerful image in his latest story from eastern Ukraine. They're out there, somewhere, he writes, among the sunflowers and the wheat fields. About 80 bodies, the remaining passengers and crew from Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, and no one can reach them because of the heavy fighting going on. Max Seddon is on the line now with us from eastern Ukraine in Donetsk. Ukrainian President Poroshenko created this ceasefire zone 25 miles around the crash site, but there's fighting going on there. What's going on?
Well, the reason there's fighting around the crash site is because President Poroshenko launched an offensive on Sunday. He decided to do this just as 40 Dutch police officers who had agreed to guard the site and protect it from looters and what have you finally arrived in Donetsk 10 days after the crash. And since then, for 3 days now, they have been unable to access the site because the road through it goes through towns where there is very heavy fighting at the moment. And Ukraine initially denied they were launching the offensive. Then they have since then continued to claim that they are not actually violating Poroshenko's decree because they're not doing any military activities within the crash site area itself, which they still admit to not having secured. But they are also neglecting the fact that the towns that are seeing the fiercest fighting, they fall within the 25-mile radius of the crash site that Poroshenko declared a ceasefire in. So the Ukrainians really bear as much responsibility as anyone else for complicating international efforts to secure the site.
What about the international investigators who are trying to get to the crash site? Do they have a daily ritual of kind of getting to this 25-mile perimeter and then saying, oh, there's fighting, we're going back to the hotel? How are they, where are they, and what are they doing?
Well, what they do, they get up in the morning, they're in this hotel, they sit around for a while in the restaurant in the lobby of the hotel, and they have breakfast. And then eventually some of them, but not the whole team, will drive off towards the site, and they see that it's still blocked off, and they go back. And as far as I can tell, the vast majority of them just seem to spend the whole time sitting around in the hotel eating club sandwiches. Some people I spoke to today in some residential areas at Donetsk, which were hit by shelling, were furious that the OSCE monitors who are accompanying these international experts hadn't showed up hours after this had happened when journalists were there working on the scene and rebel emergency workers were trying to clean things up and evacuate people. They hadn't come to do anything. So there's a lot of resentment from the local population.
Still, Max, you'd think the government in Kiev would be thinking we could score some propaganda points by allowing these investigators into the crash site. So do you think this military action has more value for them? And if so, what's that value?
I don't think that that's even necessarily what they're thinking about. I think it's quite obvious that the real purpose of this offensive isn't to secure the crash site. That is got to be at best a secondary concern because it was perfectly easy the entire time to get to the crash site until they launched this offensive. The real point of this is that it completely cuts off Donetsk from the eastern half of the rebel-held area and also from the Russian border. And it would make it much easier for them to defeat the rebels.
Max, I know war can't always be assessed with a score, but is it clear who's winning the war in Ukraine right now?
Well, if you're talking about the longer term, then Ukraine is definitely on the front foot here. They have taken a large amount of territory in recent weeks, and there doesn't appear to be a way for the separatists to win militarily unless there's some sort of drastic intervention by Russia, which doesn't look like it's going to happen. The prime minister of the separatists, Alexander Borodai, who's a Russian citizen with no connection to the region, he was, Ukraine released an intercepted conversation, which very much sounded like him talking to a former senior Russian official last week, where he said that if the front didn't dramatically shift in their favor in 2 weeks, then they wouldn't be able to hold out any longer. Whether in the long term, if Ukraine wins, that they can really call this a victory is another question, because the population here is, for the most part, so angry at the central government.
Well, it is a confusing situation in Ukraine, but you're always good at bringing some clarity to it, Max. Max Sedin of BuzzFeed in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The European Union seems fed up with Russia for its alleged support of the rebels in Ukraine. And today, the EU imposed broad new sanctions on Russia's state banks, as well as on some of its defense and energy sectors. It also targeted members of Vladimir Putin's inner circle. Matthew Dalton is with the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Brussels. Elaborate for us a bit, Matthew, on what kind of squeeze the EU is actually trying to put on Russia.
Well, it's the first step in so-called phase three sanctions, which are the economic sanctions across entire sectors of the Russian economy. Until now, the EU and the US also have been targeting individuals and a few individual companies with sanctions. This is the first time that they've targeted entire sectors. For example, they're restricting the ability of Russia's state-owned financial institutions to raise capital and financing on European capital markets. There will be an arms embargo between Russia and the EU.
I noticed that Russia's giant oil company Gazprom is not there. Rosneft, the state-owned oil and gas company. Why did the EU leave those off the list?
Well, that would be significantly beyond where the EU is prepared to go because the EU buys a lot of its energy from those two companies.
Right. So the EU is trying to be a little politically expedient about all of this. But then I have to ask, do these sanctions have any real teeth?
They do. I think for Russia, they will have teeth. Russian financial institutions not being able to borrow, not being able to raise equity on European markets is a pretty big deal, and it could raise the cost of financing for the Russian economy. It could cause the ruble to devalue further. It could cause Russia to burn through some foreign currency reserves supporting these banks, which is not a light thing for the Russian government.
Do you see any scenarios in which the proposed sanctions that we're hearing about, could they backfire on Europe in any way?
Well, I think Russia will certainly retaliate against particular sectors of the European economy. If you're a Western company, a European or American company in Russia right now, you're going to have a lot to worry about. I don't think the government is going to be kind to you right now.
When you say the Russian government isn't going to be kind to people who are European or U.S. business types, what does that mean?
Well, I think you've seen hints of it already. For example, there were increased health inspections of McDonald's in Russia.
Right.
There was a bill introduced on Tuesday that would effectively prevent the big four accounting firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers and KPMG, from doing business in Russia. So This is something that is definitely going to be worrying a lot of American firms in Russia that have, since the end of the Cold War, started doing a lot of business there.
I'm curious to know, too, in Brussels, like what the discussion is like between the European countries. I mean, Netherlands just lost nearly 200 of its citizens on the MH17 over Ukraine. On the other hand, other countries are worried about gas coming in. Is there a polarizing kind of thing going on in Brussels?
There was a debate before the Malaysian Airlines crash about countries that were more hawkish and those that were more dovish and more worried about the economic impact. However, what the crash did was it moved the entire debate closer to the hawkish side. The hawkish nations became more hawkish and the dovish nations became significantly less dovish. The most drastic shift was in a country like the Netherlands, where it almost lost 200 citizens in that crash. They went from being a very cautious player in this debate to being on the hawkish side. And that really kind of tipped the balance towards moving ahead with economic sanctions against Russia.
Matthew Dalton with The Wall Street Journal in Brussels. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
President Obama also announced further U.S. sanctions today against Russia, targeting the energy, arms, and finance sectors. I'm not saying Russia isn't taking all of this seriously, but Russia's parliament has also been focused on other matters. It's been on a tear lately when it comes to banning things. Recent targets include swearing in the arts and media, also smoking in cafes and restaurants. But earlier this month, one ban took effect that's got one niche group very upset, the lovers of lingerie. As of July 1st, underwear made from synthetic lace can no longer be imported into or manufactured or sold within the Eurasian Customs Union. That includes Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Here's the world's interpreter of all manner of Slavic curiosities, Alina Simone, with an explanation of sorts.
Listen up, ladies. Russian politicians have decided that synthetic underwear is bad for your health. The problem has something to do with low hygroscopicity. Wait, what? Let me try to put it a bit more simply. Allegedly, underwear with a high percentage of things like polyamide, nylon, and polyester doesn't allow your skin to breathe properly. The ban technically applies to all kinds of synthetic underwear, but experts say the lingerie market will be hit especially hard. So how do Russian women feel about this? I make an emergency Skype call to my cousin's wife, Olya Grishkova, who lives in St. Petersburg. Nothing that happens in Russia surprises me anymore, Olya tells me. But this gives the impression that we have no other problems right now, right? I mean, if they're discussing underwear problems at the legislative level, Olya tells me that she loves her lingerie and believes in freedom of choice when it comes to underwear, but some Russian women can commiserate with the reasoning behind the ban.
Я чесалась от них каждый день. У меня была жуткая аллергия с какими-то вот просто красными пятнами.
Галина Кулешова moved to the U.S. from Moscow 15 years ago. She remembers her oppression under the regime of fake lace under things back in the Soviet era. I was itching because of them every day, Galina says. I had a terrible allergy with a rash all over my skin. And one fine day, it reached a point where I grabbed all my lace underwear, I was 23 at the time, and threw them in the fireplace. Since then, I only wear 100% cotton underwear, Galina insists. Galina's convinced that many girls have this problem, but exactly how many Russian women suffer from allergies to synthetic underwear remains unknown. That's because no actual data were gathered by the Russian parliament before lawmakers passed the measure. Clearly, the Russian Duma, whose membership is more than 85% male, isn't taking any chances. Take heart, though. Some Russian government officials think banning the majority of lingerie on behalf of these sufferers goes too far. If synthetic underwear does pose a health threat, they say, why not just treat it like cigarettes or alcohol and put a warning on the label? Also, Russian lawmakers know from experience that bans like this can backfire.
When they disallowed alcohol, specifically vodka, there were riots on the street.
That's my mom, Ina, reminiscing about Mikhail Gorbachev's attempt to ban vodka back in the mid-80s. That worked out well. A black market for moonshine quickly developed, and desperate tipplers resorted to drinking cologne, window cleaner, and, worst-case scenario, insecticide. Businesses even started accepting vodka in lieu of rubles as a form of payment. Now my mom's wondering about the political effects of the lingerie ban.
Who knows, maybe even this will shake Russian political apathy.
In the meantime, though, are Russian women going to start DIYing their delicates? Knitting their own lingerie out of dental floss, fashioning camisoles out of those mesh bags oranges are sold in? Even if Russia isn't heading for a panty riot, my cousin's wife, Olya, is already planning on taking matters into her own hands. Or legs. If they are seriously banning lace underwear, I'll secretly travel abroad to buy it, Olya says. Maybe, she kind of jokes, I'll just put a whole lot on under my clothes so no one will notice when I cross the border. Which brings Olya to the question, how exactly will Russia keep people from continuing to wear this stuff? They'll probably invent some kind of sensors, or they'll x-ray people or something, Olya says. Either that, or being a Russian cop just got a whole lot more fun. For The World, I'm Alina Simone.
Yeah, but why stop at undies? The Fair Russia Party is sending a bill to Parliament that calls for a ban on high heels, not to mention sneakers, moccasins, and ballet flats. You know, due to that increasing concern about bursitis and flat feet. So if you're flying into Russia, you might want to leave your Chuck Taylors along with your liquids and synthetic garter belts at the TSA scanner. A short note now before the break. The London-based International Union for Conservation of Nature has bad news for fans of the pangolin. What's a pangolin, I hear you ask? Good question. They're kind of a scaly anteater, and they're facing extinction, says Jonathan Bailey. He's director of conservation programs at the Zoological Society of London.
They're found all across Asia into Africa. And while most species are suffering from habitat loss, and the pangolin is no exception, exploitation or hunting is actually the greatest threat. And essentially, they've been removed from much of China. And the latest big seizures have come from places like Sierra Leone or Cameroon.
Conservationists say that over the past decade, more than a million pangolins have been snatched from the wild. It has to do with their scales. They've been used in Chinese medicine for a long time, but more recently, the meat has become a coveted luxury product. The BBC's Fuchsia Dunlop is a cook and food writer specializing in Chinese cuisine.
With China's economic development in the 1990s, that's when people started going crazy for eating it. And it is because, you know, if someone wants to impress someone, to give face to an honored guest, in the West, people might spend a lot of money on wine. But in China, people often want to get something really special to eat. And that's one of the problems.
All that demand, conservationists say, have made the pangolin perhaps the most illegally traded animal in the world right now. Just ahead, the dangers of being an environmental activist in Brazil. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you've got The World on your radio. I want to start this next story with a number, 908. That's how many environmental and land reform activists were assassinated around the globe between 2003 and 2013, in 10 years. That's according to a study by the NGO Global Witness. If you find that shocking, here is another stat just as mind-boggling. Nearly half those murders took place in one country, Brazil. Here's Jerry Haddon from Rio de Janeiro.
Guarabana Bay, just minutes from downtown Rio's world-famous beaches, is a study in pollution and filth. Dark sludge cakes the shoreline. Garbage floats everywhere. It's so bad that some sailors set to compete here in the 2016 Summer Olympics are warning colleagues not to let this water touch their skin, which doesn't surprise local fisherman Sandy Anderson de Souza. He says he was out in his boat in 2001 when Brazil's state-run oil giant Petrobras accidentally dumped 1.3 million liters of oil into the waterway. He says there was so much oil, it looked like there was no water at all. A year later, we noticed that many species of fish were disappearing, and we started to catalog this. There are 46 species of fish and shrimp that are no longer here. That incident and several others, Anderson says, led him to tie up his boat to begin campaigning to save the bay. Think about it, he says. If you put one drop of oil in a glass of water, you can't drink it. Imagine what those millions of liters did to the bay. 13 of us became activists here. Soon, we started getting threats, he says. Before we knew it, 4 of our leaders had been killed. Anderson lifts his shirt to show 2 scars he says were caused by bullets meant to silence him as well. He blames armed security groups working for Petrobras, a claim the company denies. What's clear is that someone powerful wanted Anderson dead, and still does, which is why the Brazilian government put him in a special activist protection program. In other words, they've hidden him away. For a few years now, Anderson, his wife, and their children have been laying low in this nondescript apartment. They rarely go outside, too scared. That fear is justified by Global Witness's study, says Rafael Dias, a human rights worker in Rio.
Brasil é país muito grande, então em muitos lugares a proteção aos defensores é muito difícil.
Brazil is a huge country, he says, and there are conflicts all over the place. There are not enough resources to safeguard human rights. In the case of urban activists, he says, you have an additional phenomenon, the armed groups known as militias. They're often police or ex-police who use their public security training to go after activists. The danger isn't just found in cities. Over 1,000 miles away, in the tropical savanna that precedes the Amazon forest, a small indigenous tribe called the Xavante is also under threat from soybeans. Their reserve is literally surrounded by huge plantations of it. Xavante activist Iparici Toptiro says, like Anderson, he's been shot, trying to stop big agribusiness from encroaching on his territory.
Na medida que você contraria interesses econômicos, você se torna uma pessoa visada.
It's dangerous to talk to the international media, he says. On the one hand, it helps to get the word out, but it's also a quicker path to your own death. Journalist Fernando Molica says things won't get safer for Brazilian activists until the long-standing links between money, power, and security are broken. What makes Brazil particularly deadly, he says, are its vast forested hinterlands, where the justice system is absent or easily corrupted, and where valuable natural resources are abundant. Anytime you criticize economic interests, you become a watched person, he says. In the case of the Amazon, the police are often linked to the economic powers and the politicians. Politicians are often in the farmers' or loggers' pocket. It's delicate, which is what most worries Sandy Anderson, the activist fisherman, even as he hides in his safe house near Rio. He says the government recently took away his bodyguard, saying he was facing less danger. But he says he doesn't buy that. I feel like at any moment I could open the door and be killed, he says. I know why the government recently took my guard away. We activists have stopped some new government oil projects here on the bay. Government projects. The same government paying for my protection. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Rio de Janeiro.
A disheartening tale from Brazil there. So let's stay in Brazil and lighten the load just a bit. With the music of Brazilian rapper Carol Conca. Os perturbados se prevalecem em
enquanto atingidos adoecem. Palavras soltas que aborrecem, esperança depois de uma prece. Um povo com crise de abstinência procura explicação pra existência. Não manda onde dão mais valor pra aparência, tem sua consequência. Negro, branco, rico, pobre, o sangue é da mesma cor. Somos todos iguais, sentimos calor, alegria e dor. Cristo, Buda, Jesus, Allah, Speed, Black, profetizou. Nosso Deus é um só, vários nomes pro mesmo Criador.
Minha música fala do lado colorido do Brasil, desse lado alegre e espontâneo.
Carol Conca says her songs are about the colorful side of Brazil, the happiness of Brazil, and its spontaneity. If you're a video gamer, you may already know Conca's music from the FIFA 2014 game soundtrack. This is not protest music, though. It's not aligning itself with anti-government demonstrators who rocked the country in the weeks before the World Cup. Carol Conca wants people to do what they often do when they hear Brazilian music, dance and party.
Sim, baladas de São Paulo, do Rio, minha música toca.
I'm glad my music is being heard in clubs from Sao Paulo to Rio, she says. Songs like Corre, Corre, Aer from her latest album, Batuque Freak. Carol Conca calls it the most motivating track on the CD. It's about going after what you want, she says. The chorus goes, the world is mine, the world is yours. And that's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Follow me on Twitter. I tweet at Marco Werman. Follow The World as well. We tweet at PRI The World. You get into this Carol Conca track, and please join us here tomorrow on the radio.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. The Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today. More at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.